This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Douglas Rushkoff. He's the author of Program or Be Programmed, 10 Commands for a Digital Age. Hi, Doug. How are you?
Hi, good.
So this book, I really want to talk about, spend most of the time talking about the book, because even though it is a relatively short book, it's really, to me, jam-packed with really important ideas. But before we start, could you just talk a little bit about how this book fits into the evolution of your own work as a media critic?
Well, it's tricky. I mean, my first real book was called Siberia, and it was, written in the late 80s, early 90s about, what was going to happen. I was trying to tell people that we were about to get not just technologies, but models of thinking and cultural opportunities through which people could much more actively design the world that they're living in. That, that we can really get our hands on the dashboards of creation here and build our society together rather than just be subjected to the plans of, elites, as we have been for however many centuries. And so really it was about my first, non-linear and hypertexty experiences and the way it changed how I saw the world, and I was chronicling a lot of the people who had been dramatically affected by these things. This was before Wired magazine or anything. It was really looking at the wonderful, crazy people who had touched these technologies and started to see the world in dramatically different ways. And, what looked like a harebrained fringe activity, and a few years later, was, rather mainstream. People actually did get personal computers and started to use email and found out about this strange internet place. And over the next, 10 or 20 years, I watched what I felt were people kind of squandering the opportunity, not seeing the applicability of these insights to other areas. So I wrote a bunch of books really saying, oh, no, this stuff can change the way you look at media so that you don't have to be coerced by advertisers. You can actually see through that. Or this can change your relationship to religion, where you can start to see religion as a process that's negotiated by people over time rather than a set of concrete beliefs. Or this can change your relationship to business. So instead of just trying to prop up old institutions, you can actually innovate inside a business and do better than if you just rely on the past. Or let's apply this to economics and see that, oh my gosh, the stuff we use that we call money is just one kind of money with certain kinds of embedded programs, and we could make other kinds of money that function other ways and serve us better. So I wrote, all these books looking at different ways to apply the internet meme, if you will, the sort of high-tech networked insight. And then I realized that I'm not going to have any luck doing that if people can't even apply it to the net itself. It started to seem to me that the net was the place that needed this open source insight, this sensibility, more than anywhere else. That kids who are raised with the net all around them, far from being the screenagers with great agency that I imagine them to be, they're accepting the programs they're using as given circumstances. So I wanted to write a book that finally went all the way back to digital technology and said, look, this is the opportunity here, and you can approach this stuff with command rather than just as recipients of another pacifying media, which is what I think the net is if we continue to exploit only these kind of faux interactive styles rather than using it to be genuine authors of our society.
No, I think you've explained it really well, and I think I noticed in particular that you the subtitle is 10 commands as opposed to commandments, which it could be if you were writing a manifesto. It's commands because you're suggesting that the command is what a programmer writes to command the machine to do what the programmer wants. And I think, you know, you start with this idea that we are essentially not in control, that even when we see all the choices that we have as users, they're choices that someone else has programmed for us. So the point that I thought you start with is really important, that people are passive consumers or passive being acted upon rather than acting as they think they are. You know, that they're, without understanding what is happening, they're letting, as you say, they're squandering an opportunity. But I guess one of the questions that really struck me was, is this really that different in that way? In other words, this behavior seems to be reflected in human culture going back forever. And that is, for instance, I don't think everyone 150 years ago knew how their cars worked or could either fix or build. Even building a car would be beyond the scope of most people's abilities. So, you know, is it really that different from the way it's been before?
In one sense, no. In one sense, yes. I mean, it's no different in that people are remaining stupid, right? In that the 80 or 90% of the population is remaining painfully and woefully unaware of the way their world works and squandering a once-in-a-millennium opportunity to become active participants in their world at a time when relinquishing responsibility for the world could mean ending it. Right, that if human beings don't actually take charge of their reality, it could become unlivable environmentally or geopolitically. The difference is though that the analogy really isn't whether a person knows how to fix their car versus just being able to drive their car. I'm not asking that someone be able to open the computer and replace the power supply or repair the screen or do soldering on the circuit board. What I'm asking is that people know how to actually use the computer, which is how to give the computer commands. So it's not really like the difference between a driver and a mechanic. It's more like the difference between a driver and a passenger. You know, if you're going to use a car, it means knowing how to drive it. Yes, you can still be taken from place to place and just sit like Miss Daisy in the back and let someone else do it. But when you let someone else do it, when you let someone else drive your car for you, when you become a passenger, then you've got to trust that they're taking you to the places that you really might want to go, that they're even letting you be aware of the places that you might want to go. And the people we are allowing to drive the car for us, you know, the Facebooks and News Corps and Googles and Apples, I don't believe that the boards of directors and the shareholders of those companies are really trying to bring us to the places where we are going to be the most active, brilliant, wonderful human beings we could be. I think they're trying to bring us to the places that will make us the best customers. And that's why we see a medium as potentially revolutionary as the net, really serving market culture and the status quo.
Right. I think that seems to reflect the history of the way the web started the internet started as a system, that it was a promise for empowerment, that it would make tools available to people that would enable them to do things they couldn't have done before. But it's almost like it was when artists move into a poor neighborhood where there isn't, you know, like a warehouse neighborhood, and turn them into lofts and, you know, kind of make artist culture. And then the next thing you know, the real estate developers come in and buy up all the property because it's become cool. And the prices go up. The artists can't afford to live there anymore. And, you know, wealthy people who affect coolness take over.
Right. And the difference in this case, of course, is that the real estate isn't as fixed. You know, when you get priced out of a neighborhood, you know, there's no more place, there's no more lofts, you just can't be there. You know, like in Soho, you know, what artists can afford to move into Soho at this point. But it, on the net, in theory, the real estate is infinite. So it's not really a question of a scarcity of resource, but a scarcity of intent. You know, it's a scarcity of time. So that instead of seeing these technologies as opportunities to remake our world, you know, for most of us, for me included, these technologies are basically time sucks. You know, that the fact that I have email makes me, it's not the fact, the way that I use email or the way that email uses me makes me less capable of doing the kinds of things I want to do in this world rather than more. Because I get about 1,100 emails a day. And that's more emails than I can effectively service. And it's not like I get, not that I can ask someone to pay me to answer an email, but it's not like answering these emails actually creates economic value for me. So if I spend the 30 seconds per email, and I would have about 10 hours a day of just doing email. What do I do then? How do I live? How do I eat? Instead I struggle. I'll spend, 4 or 6 hours a day on email and then try to make my living with the other three. And it's bizarre. And what is the email actually doing? I mean, it's kind of like a giant customer service department for my books. So if I write a book and then do a whole bunch of interviews about it, people will want to ask me questions about my book, usually so they don't have to read it or buy it. So I end up with, a few hundred times more people asking for customer service on my book than actually buy the book. But then what do? Do I say, oh, well, did you actually buy the book? Then I'll answer your email. But if I'm getting 75 cents a book anyway after everyone takes their profits, and then I spend half an hour on an email response to somebody, I understand they've spent 10 bucks or 15 bucks. It's like, it's really tricky. So I'm living in a world, and we all are, where our devices are very often asking more from us, or the people on the other side of our devices are allowed to ask more from us than we can put out. And it's not just because I'm some semi-famous writer. This is everybody. Everybody is busy servicing, their Twitter and their Facebook identities and this and that. I mean, so then you end up, working in order to make money to buy technologies that you hope you can earn money on. It ends up a bizarre, very difficult cycle to get out of.
Well, that's sort of one of the questions that you suggest, and that I really I want to talk about a little bit is, faced with the difficulties that the evolution of the web has created as a social being. I think it's you're not alone in describing it this way, but it's a kind of vast mechanism of weak bonds, as opposed to real life, which is mechanisms of strong bonds.
Mm-hmm.
But we're all kind of, there's so many ways that the internet, computers, web culture provides value and entertainment, and it gets people some things that they want. But the real question, I guess, is what do you do then proscriptively to change the way things are if you're just a single individual human being in the face of, what is a giant machine? And as you suggested before, it's a machine that is not necessarily run for the benefit of the users, even though it appears that way. How do users effectively regain agency over their own lives, over the machinery, and over the culture? I mean, that's a really significant challenge.
Well, first off, you can't really do it as an individual. You know, once you are relating to the machine as an individual, it has you. You know, that was really the purpose of the industrial age and consumerism to begin with. It was to reduce people to individuals so that they wouldn't have peer-to-peer connections, either socially or commercially, and would have to do everything through these large centralized entities that basically extract value from individuals. You know, it's kind of Marxism 101, but it's true. The more individually you act, the less empowered you are. And the more collectively you act, the more fun you have and the more empowered you are. You know, it was the logic in some sense behind, labor unions, which were created so that human beings could fight back against these giant, highly centralized entities called corporations that were, created by the industrial age. Well, now we have a very similar kind of struggle between individuals who are overwhelmed by what you're calling, the machine, which is the combination of all the networks of all the people coming through corporations at us, and they don't have the sort of the real world social networks to create any alternative means of doing anything. You know, it's like we make our money and we buy our things, we do everything through the terminal. And once you're using the terminal to do that, you're actually using highly centralized methodologies for connecting to other people. I mean, yeah, you can sell something to someone on eBay, but what is it? That is a person you'll never see, you'll never have a relationship with, and you're doing it through this giant corporation.
Right. Now, I think what you're suggesting, in fact, is that political action may, in fact, be weakened by this dislocation, because what we have is, on the one hand, you see in the last presidential election, Obama raised millions of dollars, touched millions of people, and on some level empowered them because a lot of people went out and voted who might not otherwise have voted. But on the other hand, it didn't build any long-term relationships between people that were strong enough to cause them to continue to act.
Right. I was writing about that during the election. The problem was, Obama was very good at getting people to friend him, but he wasn't really good at getting people to friend one another. You know, it's like one thing to have a whole bunch of Twitter followers. It's another to have a bunch of Twitter followers who are also following each other. You know, one is creating peer-to-peer connections between people, and the other is just creating a 20th century style movement. You know, it was great as a campaign. You know, God bless. You know, he could raise money and do a campaign and get people to vote for him. But that's like marketing. It's not civics. You know, what they were unable to do was to create the mechanisms through which people could do government, could participate in the running of their country. And that's not rocket science. That's just reorienting to these media. So, you know, in answer to the question before that, I think the first step is for people to have real lives, is to start doing some things in real life and realizing that, you know, the majority of the value they create in this world is going to be real value for real people, and to look at ways to do that, whether it's babysitting or farming or all these things. I mean, we are at the very end of our value as, you know, cogs in the industrial machine. They've outsourced us. They've replaced us. They've made those skills more efficient. The sort of the whole cubicle to office mentality, it just doesn't really work. We don't need managers anymore. And all that middle management is gone. We need people who can actually do stuff and people who can be super creative and innovative in creating new ways of doing stuff. And the whole middle is gone. So people who can actually do stuff are going to be valuable, and those of us who don't know how to do stuff, we're going to have to learn how to do stuff. And these are not unfun things. Babysitting is fun, baking is fun, healthcare is fun. I mean, any of these things, any of these real jobs are fun to do, and they connect you with other people in valuable ways. You know, even the way that doctors are getting kind of paid less and less sort of indicates what's going on a certain level. Like doctors, farmers, teachers, in some sense, are the only people who create real value in this world, other than the sort of artist, innovator, scientist people who are really out there researching new modalities. You know, and the other thing we have to look at is whether we want an employment-driven economy. You know, what if we get to the point where really only 10% of people need to work, or people only need to work, you know, 3 days a month in order for there to be enough actual stuff for people? Then we realize we have it ass backwards. Then it's like, oh my gosh, I mean, the only reason we're having people work is so that we know how to divvy up the stuff that's already in abundance, and that all this extra working is just creating more manufacturing and crap that we don't need and more pollution and taking time away from our families and love and sex and all that wonderful stuff, which I actually believe to be the case. Then it's like, okay, so now we're basically trying to run an abundant 21st century economy on a 13th century economic operating system based in scarcity. That's not going to work. And if we're using our machines to reinforce this sort of notion of total employment, then we're screwed. You know, we're screwed coming and going.
So you think it changed? Are you thinking more about changing? I guess, you know, the implication of what you're saying is that we have to figure out a different actual way of living. It has nothing to necessarily to do with the internet. It has to do with changing our relationship to production and our relationship to each other.
Right, and the experience of the internet, for me anyway, opened all that up. You know, if it was for me, the net and computers were like, you know, in the 60s, like acid was for you know, Leary and Ginsberg. The net seems to me such. I find it odd that people can have contact with the net and not see all this pretty fast, but they can, because the net's not. I mean, the net today is not the net that I knew. The net is opaque. It's, you know, the net may as well be TV for most people. I mean, you get your little box to type in your text for your personal blog, linking to other people's blogs, but you're not really exposed to the utter plasticity of that environment, the true do-it-yourself, bottom-up, participatory sensibility of world creation. In there. It's only the fringes that kind of get that. The people running around in Second Life or even old text muds that get that insight that, oh, I get it. The net is completely fabricated, as is a whole lot of the social reality that I've accepted as given circumstances.
Yeah, no, I think that is a key issue. But see, I guess that goes back to my earlier point, which maybe I didn't express so well, and that is I wonder if it is possible for that dynamic to change. That, you know, will it be possible for more people to take the web as a tool of empowerment rather than as a device of consumption, to become active rather than passive? The worry that I have is that it tends to, as you call it, a media bias. I think the bias of the culture seems to go in that direction of ease, comfort, lack of challenge, you know, lack of engagement. Don't accept anything that's difficult. Just go for the easy. You know, all of those things that kind of mark a passive consumer society. That, you know, it's a kind of almost like bourgeois values that enabled fascism in the 30s, which were people really just wanted to be comfortable. They wanted their food. They wanted their trains. They didn't want to have their lives disrupted. They didn't want to think deeply about anything. They would just rather go on about their business. And what you worry about is, of course, that the way the web now operates, it heightens that even further.
Right. I mean, and I'm trying to remain hopeful. I mean, most of the evidence seems to indicate that people would rather actually be part of a faceless crowd and would rather not participate than assume responsibility for the world we live in. You know, it's like a terrific insight, like the sort of Israelite tradition can emerge, you know, which is basically communicating to people that, oh my gosh, you are in charge of this world. Human beings are going to write the laws through which we negotiate our reality, And, you know, you give it a few centuries and people forget, you know, and they turn the religion into, you know, passivity, faith, you know, a nation state. I mean, all this, all the stuff that it was actually created to cure, it becomes. You look at Seymour Papert at MIT came up with Lego Mindstorms. I was a big fan of what he was doing. It was a beautiful programmable Lego, and it turned out only 10 or 12% of kids were interested in that. The other ones wanted Bionicles, which were Legos that weren't even Legos. Lego sets that told you how they should be put together.
Right. They were like the instructed version of Lego rather than the created version.
Right. And the question is whether that's the way people naturally go, or whether that's the way, by the time people are 10 or 11 years old, that's the way people have been trained to go by, you know, God knows what, public education or something off. I mean, my daughter's in public school now, and I'm scared to death that she's going to get deadened.
Well, yeah, but that actually it does go. I think actually education reflects and also then acts as an instrument of control. But it does seem that, you know, that whole model of learn by rote rather than learn to think, it does start in that educational model, that people are trained to accept information and learn how to master knowledge, not necessarily master information rather than master knowledge.
Right, and the problem is computers master information better than us.
That's right.
So
they should theoretically then enable us to be more powerful actors rather than more passive actors.
Right.
And that,
in theory. That's what I'm saying. You know, and right. We knew how to program, whether we're programming our computers or programming our world, you know, that would be the case.
But see, I would take what you're saying then as a metaphor for you know, almost like a social political message, which says you need to take power over your daily lives rather than giving that power to others, whether it's machines or people or, you know, the unknown. Or it's the, you know, the forces that we can't quite grapple with on an individual basis, as we talked about before. That there may be, you know, the deal then is, taking power may mean something fairly radical.
It may.
And we don't know what that looks like. I think you mentioned something else that I wanted to talk about, and that is how do you remain optimistic in the face of what look to be all of these negative functionalities. You know, that you know, how does the individual, because we are, after all, individuals, we have to think individually first before we can act collectively. How do we find a way to see the positive outcome in the face of all these challenges?
Was that a question or a
statement? Yeah. That is a little rhetorical, I guess, but I guess I'm, you know, I think that where your book comes down is that actually there is a lesson there, and that is you can literally program your reality if you choose to accept the challenge to learn those tools.
Right. I mean, and in some cases they're digital tools, in some cases they're not. But, you know, if we're moving into a digital age, then these are the primary modes of communication, self-expression, and world creation. And while I understand that people of these generations may not choose to learn this language, just as people chose not to, you know, learn how to read and write for centuries after text was developed, I want people to at least know it exists, that these environments are programmed. They're programmed by people with agendas who want you to act or be in certain ways. And if people can't get that much, then indeed, then all is lost. But I think people can at least be brought to accept the notion that these environments have agendas, they have purposes embedded into them, and that knowing those purposes, or at least even knowing that you don't know those purposes, can lead to a much more predictable set of outcomes, rather than this sense that people have now. They do something in a digital space and have no idea what's really going to result from doing it.
Well, I think that is a perfect place for us to end, because I think you've just described perfectly the message of the book. I really think that this is a book that a lot of people should read. I think it's very important. Program or Be Programmed, 10 Commands for a Digital Age by Doug Rushkoff. Thanks so much for talking to me, Doug.
Well, thanks for caring.